Welcome to the Hinckley Institute of Politics. My name is Preston Connor, and I will be the host for today's Hinckley Forum. The Hinckley Institute of Politics was established in 1965 through the generous bequest of the Nobel Foundation and Robert H. Hinckley. The Institute is dedicated to teaching student respect for practical politics and the principle of citizen involvement in government. The Hinckley Institute offers paid internships to students of all majors here locally in Washington, D.C., and in 55 countries around the globe. The Hinckley Institute also offers classes, the nation's only campaign management minor, week-long experiences to Washington, D.C., and over $70,000 in academic scholarships. We invite students to go next door or to our website at www.hinckley.utah.edu for more information. The title of today's forum is Sustainability Leadership, and Amy J. Wildermuth, Associate Vice President for Faculty, Interim Chief Sustainability Officer, and a Professor of Law at the University of Utah, will introduce our guest.
Thanks so much, and thank you for so many of you coming out on a beautiful Friday afternoon. If I was the only one walking over and thinking, should we do this outside, right? Maybe we should have. Oh, it's nice and warm. So anyway, it's my great pleasure today to eventually introduce our terrific speaker, David Orr. But we're going to kick off the event today with our inaugural Sustainability Awards. So I am going to invite Anno. Are you guys in the back? Okay, come on up. We're going to present the four awards that we are doing for this year. So many of you received the announcement about the new ALTA Sustainability Awards. And we have these two to thank for these terrific awards. So if you would join me in thanking them. Okay. So I'm now going to invite the winners to come forward. But before you come forward, I'm going to announce it, and then I'm going to give you a little sense of what these folks have done. So the first award that we have is the Campus as a Living Lab Award. And this went to Yukan Feng, a doctoral student in civil and environmental engineering. What he did was to measure the water and energy budgets associated with green roofs to improve use and planning. This was a highly visible project, and it provides an opportunity to educate and inspire others. So you can please come forward. Thanks so much. And we're going to do this. We got pictures over here, please.
Oh, sorry.
We're going to take pictures. Okay, we're going to have you hold. Okay, we get good getting close. Sorry, we've got to make sure we have the pictures. Okay, thank you. We'll try to make it painless. All right, great. All right. Our next award for community partnership goes to Rob Kent. Rob Kent is a doctoral student in psychology, applied his research on behavioral change campaigns to make the Clear Air Challenge a better annual program. So he was trying to improve the capacity to make a difference. He targeted proven strategies, and we think that this will make campaigns like the Clear the Air Challenge more effective and actually reduce unnecessary costs. So Rob, please come forward. All right. Our next award goes to someone who has integrated sustainability education, somebody who has been doing this for quite some time. Julia Corbett developed climate change communication class with the help of a grant. She brought nationally renowned speakers to the university to educate her class and the university community. She has spent her career adopting sustainability principles into all classes and brought the first environmental communication course to the U 18 years ago. Julia, come on forward. I know. It's like you were a baby.
Yeah.
Thank you.
All right. All right. And our last award is for sustainability research. And it's another person that we're going to honor for quite some time working on sustainability issues. So Barbara Brown is a professor in family and consumer science studies. She has spent the last 30 years researching environmental sustainability and healthy communities. She's the editor of Environment and Behavior Journal, and she currently researches and examines how adding a public transit line impacts residents' obesity rates. So, Barbara, thank you so much. Let me get your award. Here we go. All right. Okay. Thanks. All right, so one more round of applause for all our award winners. Thank you so much for your contribution. And again,
yeah. I have to just say one quick word on behalf of the Alta Environmental Center, part of the Alta ski area. We're really happy to be working with you and seeing the support for this and seeing it going across so many disciplines. Thank you very much.
All right. Thank you. And Anna, we really appreciate your generosity. This is a terrific thing for sustainability and for the university. So thank you so much for being here today and for leading the way on this. Okay, so now it is my great pleasure to introduce David Orr. Now, David might not remember this, but he actually served on my brother's PhD committee. I don't know if you remember this. And I think you had a good conversation about his dissertation while you were in transit, as I recall. So David is a terrific and good friend to the Wildermuth family. Thank you so much. My brother did complete that degree. and we are just so pleased to have him here today. Many of you have had a chance to spend some time with David. He will talk to us for a little while, and then I'm sure he will take some questions. So, with no further ado, I'd like to introduce David Orr.
First, a question for all of you. What are you doing in here on a day like today? We get one day like this in Ohio every 5 or 6 years. And if we had ski resorts right outside there, we'd be out there. Really nice to be here. And I'm going to say just a few things and open up for questions and some thoughts. And I want to talk about environmental leadership. And for all of you, this is really aimed for you students. It's what are you going to do with the rest of your life? And so this one is career counseling kind of things. And I want to start with a story of a student of mine who was one of my advisees. And Vinny came to Oberlin sometime in the early to mid-1990s. And in the first interview as an advisee, he says, what do you want to do? And he said, well, I want to be a doctor. And so, great. It's a good field. Then he proceeded for 3 years and a bit more to turn in C's and C minuses and D pluses and a B minus every now and then. So he had, for medical school, he had eliminated every medical school north of Port-au-Prince. And his parents showed up in senior year. I had not met them before. And his parents were dismayed that Vinny had gotten this very indifferent academic record, and he was going off to medical school. And I realized right away there was a problem, because his parents showed up in my office, and they were dressed to the nines. His dad was at Kettering Memorial Hospital in New York. His mother was a cancer researcher, both had PhDs and famous people. And I realized, uh-oh, there's a problem. And they blamed Vinny's academic record on me. And so we finally got them out of my office, and I said, Vinny, let's go uptown and get a cup of coffee. And we did. We walked uptown, and I said, Vinny, what do you want to be? He said, you know, I just really want to be a doctor. I said, Vinny, that's bullshit. He said, you don't want to be a doctor. What do you want to be? He looked at me for a long time. We were just crossing a curb, and he stumbled on the curb as we walked across. He looked at me for a long time, and he said, do you want to know? I said, yeah. He said, you know, ever since I read Little Red Riding Hood as a kid, I've been nutty about wolves. I have pictures of wolves on my walls, and I subscribe to the Journal of Wolfology or whatever it is, but he was nutty about wolves. I said, well, that's interesting. You don't really want to be a doctor. He says, oh, probably not really. So Vinny, I called a friend of mine who had a wolf research project up in Montana, and I don't know whether he was researching ranchers relative to wolves or wolves relative to ranchers. But anyway, I called and said, could you take on a research assistant? And he said, yeah, we can do that this summer. So Vinny went to Montana, worked with a research project on wolves, and became a pretty distinguished wildlife behavior biologist. That's interesting. Point of the story is this. It's your life, and you need to find out what you're here on the planet for. And there's a kind of a strategic junction you have to make. We have career counseling at Oberlin, and you can get a career inside a calling, but it's really hard to do the reverse. The point is, get your calling. Find out why you're on the planet first, and then find a career in that. It could be business, it could be law, it could be wildlife biology, whatever. Do you know what I mean? Find out what you're here for, and then find a career within that calling. Now, the word calling harkens back to the old, my Presbyterian upbringing, where you had to have a calling and so forth, but it's a perfectly serviceable word. It's a good word. Find out why you're here first. Have a life first, not a career. Trust your intuition. Don't try to be too clever and outthink life. It'll beat you every time. Stay open to possibilities and decide what is important to you. Have a compass you put on the table that tells you which direction magnetic north may be. A compass is not an itinerary. It just tells you what's important. So the calling functions like that compass. Now, what do you do with yourself and so forth? On my compass, it was all about environment. I came to this kind of late in life, probably my early or late in my academic career, probably early 20s. But environment is the issue of our time. When Martin Rees, the astronomer royal, wrote his book, Our Final Hour, he gave us, he thought, a 50-50 chance, us meaning civilization, of making it to the year 2100. And then he said in his next book, some of his scientific colleagues called him and said, Martin, you are way too optimistic. It's not 50-50. It may be, you know. So the odds are long, and we've got a lot of work to do. The numbers are daunting. We're 7.2 billion people on the planet. We're headed for a planet of 10 billion. A year ago, for the first time, CO2 in the atmosphere went over 400 parts per million. There's no one in this room that could give a good reason why we'll stop it short of 450 or 500 or even more than that. But as it goes up, our prospects as a civilization go down. We have good reason to believe that 25 to 50% of the species now on board Earth with us will disappear within this century. We're undergoing what somebody's referred to as a biological holocaust. 80 people, according to a recent Oxfam report, 80 people, you could fit them in this room, have more net wealth than the bottom 3.6 billion people on the planet. 80 people have more net wealth than the bottom 3.6 billion people. So we've come into an era that's being labeled the Anthropocene as opposed to the Holocene. But we as a species grew up in that era of the Holocene, an abnormal era. Climate was relatively stable. We're now in an era where we as Homo sapiens are the drivers in the economy and drivers on the planet and drivers on the future of Earth systems. What's to be done? So when you think about your future, Thomas Berry, not Wendell Berry, but Thomas Berry, who was a religious historian and priest, Thomas wrote a little book called The Great Work. And every generation has some kind of great work that they're given. And it's never chosen. It's thrust upon them. And so in the 1860s, the great work of young people in the 1860s was to fight slavery and to fight for human dignity. And they did it, and they listened to the speeches that Abraham Lincoln made in 1858 and 59 and 60, and they believed those ideas so much that they went off and they fought, and many of them died for those ideas. They were citizens, but their great work, which we still undergo, was to fight for human dignity. The great work of the greatest generation, Tom Brokaw's term, was to fight Nazism and communism from 1930s into the end of the Cold War era. And it cost many of those people their lives and fortunes and so forth, but it was a great work. They didn't want to go fight and die in places that had names like Iwo Jima or the Battle of the Bulge, but they did it. And their great work was to fight that battle and to fight depression, to fight oppression, to fight for democracy, justice, and freedom as they best understood it. So our great work starts with imagination. Can you imagine a world better than what we have now? Can you create a world that's better? Not just imagine it, but take that world into being. Can you restore what has been broken and damaged? Can you heal what has been diseased? Can you provide solace for the psychological pain that we'll see in that world? As Gary Snyder once put, find your place on the planet and dig in. And when you dig in, begin to do that great work where you are with the skills and talents that you've got. And do it with what Martin Luther King called the fierce urgency of now. Time is the one thing we don't have in abundance. And in the specifics of that transition, we've got to go from a world powered mostly by fossil fuels to a world now powered by sunshine and efficiency. That isn't a technological problem. We have the technology to do that. It isn't even an economic issue. We have the economics now on our side. You can generate power in all of its forms, and power and heat and thermal and so forth and electricity, cheaper now from sunlight and efficiency than burning fossil fuels. It's a leadership issue. It's a question now, do we have the wherewithal at all levels of society to lead on that issue? We need a new economy, that world where 80 people have more net wealth than the bottom 3.6 billion people on the earth. That is a prescription for disaster. That new economy has got to be equitable. It's got to be fair. It's got to be durable. It's got to be resilient. We can barely imagine that, but imagine it, we must do. It's a world where we've got to create peace. There's still something like 10,000 warheads variously accounted for on the planet. And the control systems for those warheads, I have to believe, after everything I've read over the past 4 or 5 years, is flimsy beyond our willingness to believe it and to understand it and face it. We need a new legal regime. The laws of the land and the laws of the planet, as they now stand, permit the owners of fossil fuels to burn out all the reserves that they now control that would heat the planet, destroy the human prospect, and in doing that, they will break no law presently on the books. The rights of future generations, and I have 4 grandchildren, the rights of future generations and their grandchildren have no standing in any court of law right now. So their survival, their thrival, their chance to live on this planet in a way that's decent and fair is not vouchsafed in any legal system. How do we think about the rights of other species? Christopher Stone, an environmental lawyer in the late 1960s, wrote a little essay called Should Trees Have Standing? And in that, he raised the issue of legal rights that we would extend to other species and even landforms and rivers and mountains and so forth. And then continue on. We need new cities, those of you involved in urban planning and urban engineering systems. Imagine a city powered entirely by sunshine. Imagine Salt Lake City. I live in Ohio, and I said this morning that in Ohio, sunshine like this is still a theory. We have pictures of it. We've heard about it now. Don't mind me, but it's still a theory. You've got sunshine. Imagine a solar-powered Salt Lake City. Imagine cities where drinking water comes in and drinking water leaves, no pollution. Imagine a world fed by natural systems agriculture without pesticides, without chemicals, a world that doesn't pollute and kill as it feeds. Imagine a world of governance, politics beyond left and right. And I think in this case, we're bound up with a liberal conservative division that is artificial and phony to the nth degree. And some people make a very good living by keeping us divided, liberal versus conservative. We've got to change that. And imagine a conversation between Edmund Burke, the founder of modern conservatism, wrote a little book called Reflections on the Revolution in France. And Burke in that book says, and this is, again, as the founder of modern conservatism, Burke said that the object or the goal of any generation is to pass on an entailed inheritance from the distant past to the distant future. We're trustees. And as trustees, that entailed inheritance, by which he meant the laws and customs of a society, had to be passed on intact to the future generations. That was our obligation. That was our duty. We owed it to the past. We owe it to the future. Imagine Burke sitting down with Thomas Jefferson, who said that no generation had the right to impose debt on future generations. Imagine that conversation. There's a convergence of left and right. There are some things we don't have a right to do. Imagine our politics beyond left and beyond right, and change that dialogue that goes like this to one that goes like this. It's past with or versus the future. And then, how do you build a world where our decisions and the way we conduct the public business takes money out of the process? How do we undo the damage done by this Supreme Court decision called Citizens United? Whatever your politics are, that is the wrong decision. It opened the floodgates. It said that this government, the government by which you and I are represented, of the people and by the people and for the people, that that government could be purchased by enough money. That was wrong. And then more obscure, how do we develop a new theology that includes the earth? There's a lot of work along this line, but a theology that says, this is our home. It was given to us for reasons we don't understand, but we're now the caretakers of this earth. How about a creation theology that permeates all religions, all faith traditions? And then there are deeper questions. I mentioned this morning something called the Tale of the Jinn. It's an old Islamic tale. And in the Tale of the Jinn, animals are given voice and sentience, and they're in the jury box. And in the dock, you and I, humankind, Homo sapiens, as we proudly call ourselves, the question for the animals, given voice and sentience, they can talk and they can think. So you have the eagles and the alligators and the fish all in the jury box. And they can decide the human fate. And if they choose against us, we're gone. We're off the planet. So the Tale of the Jinn, I used to give this to my students as a problem. And from Oberlin, we're very bright kids, but they tend to have a kind of a Presbyterian view of the world, which is dark and angst-ridden. And so their first reaction to the Tale of the Jinn as the attorney for humankind was, oh, we don't deserve to survive. We need to go. We're evil and so forth. And then they think about that a little bit. And the thoughts come back that maybe we were or we are worth keeping on the planet. We're Mozart, and we're the first species to understand the rights and values of other species and the beauty and so forth. And we're Shakespeare, and we're cultures that produce amazing things over the years. But the point here is this, that if we knew better why we deserve to survive, we would understand better how to go about the process of survival. That's an important consideration. We assume that because we want to sustain ourselves that we have the right to. But the Tale of the Jinn raises another issue. Do we deserve to be sustained? We need a paradigm shift. And if you come out of 4 years of any college, you ought to understand the connectedness of things. We need to go from a Cartesian worldview, where things are broken up into fragments and bits and pieces, to a systems view of the world, where you see the patterns that connect us and connect all kinds of things. Flo Shepherd is here in the audience, and her husband, Paul Shepherd, was one of the great minds and remains such in human ecology that made this point over and over again. We need long-term thinkers. We need people who can see hope on a farther horizon. If you're hopeful about the next decade or two or whatever, you don't probably know enough. We need to reorient three words. If you're optimistic, you just don't know enough. You haven't read deeply enough or widely enough. If you're in despair, that's a sin. You really don't want to go there. The sweet spot is called hope. But hope is a verb with its sleeves rolled up. If you're hopeful, as opposed to being either optimistic or in despair, you have to do something. You have to act. And so as hopeful people, we've got to act to produce this kind of world that is very different. Now, finally, let me say two other things. This gets a little preachy, but a word about you. If you're below the age of 25, and that's most of the audience here, you don't know how good you can be. You don't know what you can do in the world. But I will tell you that it is more right now than you can imagine. So you don't know that, and you probably shouldn't know how good you can be. But you've got to rise to an occasion. You've got to do things that humans have never done before. I believe that you can. Number two, keep a sense of humor. If you can't laugh at the human condition, you just haven't taken it seriously enough. You know, read Don Quixote. Keep a vibrant sense of humor. Find the ridiculous in all kinds of things. Third, don't be too certain of your certainties. Have a reverse gear. Be able to back up. When you're wrong, say it. Number four, when you fail, and you will, get back up. Get off the mat. You never measure somebody by how successful they are. It's what they do when they weren't successful. And so another way to put this is be too dumb to know when you're beaten. That's the difference of a leader and a follower and a success and a failure. Just don't recognize. Somebody said in a previous session that the word maybe from the administration always could be turned around into a yes, and a no could always be a maybe. And so think about that. Nothing is ever finally settled. Keep at it. Be too dumb to know when you're beaten. Keep moving. Now, finally, keep an eye on the further horizon. I want to read a poem, Libby Roderick's poem called Winter Wheat. When I was young, I thought that failure was impossible. All wrongs would be righted in my time. Now I'm old, I see that failure is impossible. I pass the torch to you. Will you hold it high? For we're sowing winter wheat that other hands will harvest, that they might have enough to eat after we're gone. We'll plant shade trees that we will not sit under. We will light candles that others can see their way. We'll struggle for justice, though we never will see it flower. Our children's children will live in peace one day. When I was young, I thought there were no human enemies. People must be taught to hate and fear. Now I am old, and I know that there are no human enemies, but only souls in pain, and we can reach them if we dare. So that we're sowing winter wheat that other hands will harvest, that they might have enough to eat after we are gone. Each generation passes like the leaves, an old oak tree whose roots are strong. Each new generation bursts out like the spring, and they will be the ones to carry on. When I was young, I dreamed the earth was healed and whole. Creatures, trees, rivers, free and wild. Now I am old. I dream the planet healed and whole again. That dream's reborn forever in the heart of each new child. So we're sowing winter wheat so that other hands will harvest, that they might have enough to eat after we are gone. We'll plant shade trees that we will not sit under. We will light candles that others can see their way. We'll struggle for justice, though we will never see it flower. Our children's children will live in peace one day. We'll plant shade trees that we will not sit under. We will light candles that others can see their way. We'll struggle for justice, though we'll never see it flower. Our children's children will live in peace one day. Our children's children will live in peace one day. As leaders and as citizens of planet Earth, keep your eyes on that farther horizon. Thank you very much.
So we're going to do some questions now. Raise your hand. We'll let you call on them.
Just a quick reminder. If you have a question, please state your name, maybe your major, something about you, and speak directly into the microphone.
And the questions are supposed to be simple, yes and no kind of questions.
Try my best. So my name is Austin Holmes. I'm a junior here at the U. I'm dual majoring in environmental and international studies. And so you said a lot about how the main problems that are contributing to the issues that we're facing are sort of products of the paradigm of the sort of global political and economic systems that we're faced with right now. And we need to have a transition from that in order to solve these issues, but what would that look like particularly to you?
Is there another question that's easier? That's a great question. My starting point, I live and work and have for some years in the academic world, and so I'm a professor, or have been. And so the starting point, that transition, starts with us here in the academic world. The disorder out there, all those big numbers, the few of which I mentioned, reflect a prior disorder up here. It's how we think and how poorly we've thought about a lot of things. And so the transition I'm thinking about starts here with how you think and what you can think about. And that means that everything that happens here, everything that happens at Oberlin, every environmental, every educational institution, everything you do here is environmental education in one way or another, directly or indirectly. And so the transition, this transition era, begins with changing how we think. That gets into the nuts and bolts and down into the weeds of curriculum and courses and so forth, but also the overall design of the academy. It's time to rethink how we organize the learned world relative to the way the world works as a physical system. And I don't, there are no easy answers. There are some easy answers. If you ask, how would we power this new civilization? The answer there is by sunshine and frugality and efficiency. And those are the easy things. The harder things will be those things that are philosophical and deeper. That's why in the conversation this morning with several of you, part of this transition, I think, has to include, a big part of the transition has got to include the humanities. We've tended to take this issue of sustainability and make it an economic issue or a technical issue, and we've left out the humanities in this discourse. We've got to get them back into this discourse. This is not first and foremost a technical conversation. It's a conversation about who we are as a species. What might we become? And all this stuff about solar power, and I'm all for it, we'll open a later this year, the first entirely solar-powered hotel and conference center in Oberlin, Ohio. I think it's anywhere in the world. And again, we're in a state where sunshine is still a theory, but it works. But the deeper issues have to do with why we're here and what we're here. And all that solar power and ecological design stuff, which I've worked on for a good part of my life, just buys us time. And then the question for a species that pleased to call itself Homo sapiens is, time for what? What do we learn in that time? What do we have to do? And that gets into issues of equity and fairness and peace and justice. It buys us some time, but that's all it does right now. So the transition is contingent. We can buy ourselves some time, but eventually we have to change how we think and how we relate and how we, what kind of civilization it is we build. And now we know it's got to be a global civilization. We've got to think larger than we have thought in the past. Anyway, thanks for that question.
Hi, my name is Jessica, and I'm a freshman at the U, and my major is undecided. I just wanted to ask you about the Keystone Pipeline. It certainly is a big controversial issue in the United States, and you know, certainly economically it is beneficial to the United States, but environmentally it will cause a big problem. So I just wanted to ask your opinion about how could we balance the economics and environments.
Jessica, are you trying to get me in trouble here? I mean, thanks for the question. Keystone Pipeline needs to go. But it needs to go as part of a larger dialogue. And years back, I worked as a very small part of Jimmy Carter's administration as governor in Georgia and also his transition team. And in 1976, when Carter was running for the White House, he came into the office one day and he asked for a paper that would be on the most important environmental issue his administration would face. He was ahead in the polls by that time by a comfortable margin. And we gave him a paper that still reads well, but it was about energy policy. To us, energy was the keystone issue for an administration in 1976. The first warning to a U.S. president about climate change was given in 1965. We've had warnings. We know what we're now doing. You cannot plead ignorance any longer. You haven't been able to plead it for a long time, but for certainly not now. So we've got to get off the fossil fuel treadmill. The deeper we go into that, and this is why I'm not much of a fan of natural gas and the switch to natural gas as a, quote, bridge fuel, because the deeper we go into it, the more investment capital we put into it, then it takes longer for that capital to pay off and so forth. We just keep extending this horizon out there. In the meantime, the clock is ticking, and this is not a clock we control. It is the clock determined by carbon in the atmosphere. People who say that they don't believe in climate change, belief is not the right word here. If you say I don't believe in Moses or Jesus or you know whatever, that's fine. That's belief. But climate change is about physics and chemistry. And so no one is likely to ever tell you, you know, I just don't believe in the laws of gravity. And if they do, there's a real simple test. Come to the top of the building with me and, you know, you jump first. See how it works out for you. This is not a matter of belief. It's just a matter of hard science. So the last thing I'd say is this. In the debate about energy consumption, we tend to have this debate like we organize the academy in a university or a college. We fragment these issues. And the first issue is how much energy do we need to do what? Second issue is how much can we actually afford not to use? And all the studies going back to McKinsey's report in 2007 on energy efficiency have indicated somewhere between 40% and 80% of the energy we now consume is waste. We could do with off-the-shelf technology, we could eliminate, let's call it just round it up to at least half. So we continue to buy twice as much energy as we need at a considerable cost that we have to pay. So the point here is instead of having a debate about the pipeline, let's have a debate where we have a level playing field and let's talk about nuclear power and wind and solar and efficiency and energy in all of its forms. Do you follow what I'm saying? instead of parsing this out, and so everybody gets hissied up about the XL pipeline. And the measure we use is, jobs it will create, and that's very disputed. On one side, we're told it will create 40,000 jobs. On another side, you said those are mostly construction jobs. It will create very few permanent workers. Final thing is the rule of economics here is that we will pay for sustainability and climate balance whether we get it or not. And we'll pay as ill health, as wars, as conflict, as economic turmoil, but we will pay. And the theory is that we can't afford to do this and that. From a green perspective, you can't afford not to. From any long-term perspective, we can't afford not to. So the more rapid transition, we know we're going to have to make it. We ought to begin to make it now. Now, final point. Every study for years now has pointed to the same thing. Efficiency and renewable energy typically provide a lot more jobs than anything in the fossil fuel business or nuclear business. Those are just hard numbers, and you can stack up the reports, and they're about yay high by now. Everything says we waste more than we ought to waste, and it is economically prudent to simply eliminate that waste. So XL pipeline needs to go, and pipelines generally need to go. We need to make a rapid transition from fossil fuels to a very different world. And again, let me go back to the odds. Martin Rees' point, 50-50 chance of civilization making it to the year 2100, and it kind of goes in one ear and out the other. Somehow nature played a trick on us. We don't understand those kinds of things. If I was suddenly to turn into a grizzly bear, a half a ton of, muscle and grit and, claws and big teeth, I'd have your attention in a way I don't get it, talking to you or showing PowerPoint slides. We weren't wired for that. We were wired for dependably loathsome, scary threats. So if it's hairy with long teeth and claws and coming at you, or if I reach down here and I pull out an Uzi, your adrenal fight-flight mechanism kicks in. But it didn't kick in. There's nobody in this room that got a sweaty palms or increased heart rate because I said, CO2 levels are now at 400-plus parts per million. Nobody, it's just another number. So nature played a trick on us. It did not equip us to think our way through easily complicated issues that involve that we have to think our way through. But if dependably loathsome threats, you put a cover of grizzly bear or a name like Osama bin Laden, we're really good. We're really good. Keystone Pipeline, it's got to go. All the way in the back.
Rob Kent, 19th grader in the psychology PhD program. How can individuals make any kind of meaningful difference?
Wait, I didn't hear the last part. Rob, after...
How can individuals make a meaningful difference?
Well, somebody may have asked Rosa Parks that in Montgomery, Alabama, years ago. She just took a stand and decided she wasn't going to sit at the back of the bus. And so individuals can make a difference. They can make a lot bigger difference if individuals join into organizations. And the key here will be, how do you organize? And for me, as somebody involved in higher education, to organize as the learned community, and you think of what we've got. We have assets. We have buying power. You have buying power. You have investing power. You have endowments. You have incredible brain power. You have, 30,000 students or 35,000 students here at the U. You got smart people, and you got great faculty. And people respect what you do. They spend a lot of money to send their kids here. They still respect what you do. So imagine universities and colleges and higher education getting together. And these 18 million young people begin to band together to begin to create that new world. That's leadership. And we have every reason to want to do it. And there are reasons of self-interest. For example, building green buildings. When we did the Lewis Center years ago, it was the first entirely solar-powered building on a U.S. college campus. That building was still a stretch, but now we know the economics were actually pretty good, and it paid off in all kinds of different ways. And the collateral benefits of doing that the right way actually were hugely advantageous to the college. We've got every reason to believe that you could do the same across the board, the way you build your physical plant, make it so that this is an entirely solar-powered university. That's not out of the reach of imagination or money or anything else, or technology, certainly. So band together, come together. And then back on the first question here, you've got to change how you think. This gets into the curriculum. It'd be presumptuous, and I wouldn't know how you ought to change your curriculum. But nobody should graduate from 4 years of higher education without understanding the world is a system and understanding something about how those parts relate, which changes all the questions that you have, and how your field of knowledge relates on this larger topography of the time. How does it fit all these other issues? And then nobody should graduate without understanding that real hope is on a farther horizon. And let me just give the pressing issue is this. Carbon, as many of you know in the room, stays in the atmosphere for hundreds and thousands of years. So the carbon I burned to get out here 2 days ago will be in some portion in the atmosphere still 10,000 years from now. And if we were to stop emitting carbon this year, Susan Solomon, who's a member of the IPCC, wrote a long paper on this. The evidence is that we still have, even if we eliminate all carbon emissions right now and all other heat-trapping gases, we've got 1,000 years before, at least, before climate stabilizes in any way again. So 1,000 years of rising sea levels, changing ecologies, changing hydrology, changing everything that we take as normal. Now, our response to that is, oh, God, that is so depressing. Don't depress me. And my answer back is, I find it, if those facts are true, and they are, I find people's dismissal as that's depressing, I find that really depressing. Just suck it up. Let's get at the work of building a stable, decent, resilient, fair, beautiful civilization. But it may take us 1,000 years. Let's start the journey right now. Yesterday I started a talk with Larry McMurtry's Lonesome Dove. Y'all have read the book Lonesome Dove or seen the movie or whatever. In Lonesome Dove, Larry McMurtry has these guys sitting in a saloon, I think it is, in this dusty little West Texas town of Lonesome Dove. And it's hot and it's dry and it's barren. And somebody comes into the saloon. He has this idea of going to Montana. No one's ever been to Montana before, but they've heard it's lush and it's green and it's beautiful and there's water, everything that Lonesome Dove doesn't have. So they decide to go to Lonesome, or from Lonesome Dove to Montana. They don't, and maybe stop in, you know, Salt Lake City or something, but they don't have a clue what lies between them and Montana. The rivers they have to cross are the grizzly bears or cougars or Indian tribes and so forth they'll have to meet. And the sustainability issue is kind of like that. We tend to define sustainability as this given condition where all of a sudden, oh, now we're sustainable. No, we're not. We're not even close. This is going to be a long journey. And so I think that what we do is to figure out how we make that long journey. For me, I gave this talk yesterday, but for me in Oberlin, it's one thing. For you here in Salt Lake City, it's going to be a very different thing. There'll be some commonalities, but it's a journey. It's not a final thing that we finally get to the point, oh, now we're sustainable, we can stand down and be at our ease. It won't be that simple. There are a lot of big issues to resolve. What's one person doing this? Boy, the sky's the limit. Write a great book, do the research paper, organize, but we're better if we organize together. And I think we're even more powerful if we organize as the academic and learned community. We've got access to bright young minds, great faculty, great research facilities. We have all the assets, and people will wonder at someday, if they're able, why we didn't act sooner and faster. Time's not our friend. We need to act right now. But thanks for that question.
All right, I've got a question for you. respective of a few things that you mentioned already, Joseph Stalin was famous for saying that one death is a tragedy, a million deaths is a statistic.
Right.
And when you apply that to the current discussion, I wonder, because as I grew up, those initial warnings that you talk about in 65 and 70 were that we were headed for an ice age. Then it became global warming, and now it's climate change. What do we need to do to change our mindset so that we're doing all of these things for the right reasons in and of themselves, because mm-hmm. a solar-powered campus is a better idea, a solar-powered city is a better idea than what we have now, rather than arguing over the doom and gloom statistics of it, which removes the personal action, I think.
Well, it's a good question. Let me start and say this. Language here is really important, and I wouldn't take the language of the denialists called doom and gloom and apply that to this. So if you walk into a doctor, and the doctor says and has the test results back and says you have inoperable cancer or you have a cancer or you have a heart problem, the first response isn't to say, well, that's a liberal opinion or that's doom and gloom. We don't talk like that. And so when the doctors that study the Earth systems for a living come back in and say, we got a problem here. We're loading the carbon, the atmosphere with carbon, and the consequences are potentially catastrophic beyond some level, and we don't know what that level is. And the fact is that we're seeing things, Earth system science is showing now quantitatively, that we're seeing things happen at a larger scale and much faster and earlier than they had predicted even 5 or 10 years ago. So this is serious stuff, and we have to be able to handle serious stuff. You know, when Winston Churchill told the British people, said, you better pay attention to what goes on in Eastern Europe, and if you don't, there'll be hell to pay. And as we know, they didn't, and there was hell to pay. And so this is serious stuff. We need people who stand up and are able to speak the truth on this issue. Now, I agree with your question in saying, okay, we can't just leave it there. This conversation has been held over the course of the day. As a teacher, I don't stop with informing young people about bad news scenarios. I'm obliged to tell the truth. I want them to read Science magazine and Nature magazine. I want them to understand how the world works physically and how we're provoking it into behavior patterns we're not going to like. But then I can't stop there. That's why we got 250 students working on the design of the Lewis Center 15 years ago or 18 years ago now. That's why our goal on the Oberlin Project, to make that a model of sustainability, is to have 1,000 young people work with engineers and designers and architects and urban planners to make that city a model of sustainability. And that's why at the Lake Erie Crescent model, from Flint all the way over to Youngstown, Ohio, our goal is something like 10,000 students minimum from University of Michigan, Michigan State, and other places, working with teams of urban planners and designers and engineers and so forth to remake that urban fabric in a way that's sustainability and decent. So once they know the truth and you raise the level of anxiety or energy level, then you have to reflect or deflect that into something that's constructive, something better than what otherwise might be. But it puts us in a terrible conundrum. I mean, I would be kidding if I told you I had any kind of absolute view here. It puts us in a terrible conundrum because on one hand, you're exactly right. You can use words and numbers to cause young people to go into depression. Oh, my God, you know, beam me out of here. This is the wrong planet. Or you can begin to harness the talents and enthusiasms and the intelligence of young people into making the world better than it otherwise might be. But I think they need to know the score. Back in my Lonesome Dove analogy, it would have been really helpful if in that saloon in Lonesome Dove, the guys, and they were all guys, had a clue. Here's a map. Montana's a long way off. We've got a lot of tough rivers to cross. And, you know, we're starting the journey to Montana. Some people want to go in stretch limos, a couple of them. Most of the rest are going to have to walk. That's an interesting little problem. And we haven't worked out all the logistics of how this actual journey is going to be made, and sustainability is like that. We haven't worked out the logistics yet. We're a badly divided, over-armed world full of hatred and antagonisms and so forth with a lot of bad habits. But I happen to believe, as an educator, I've run my flag, personal flag, up the pole of education. This is a challenge to us as educators to change what we think about and how we think. And so young people coming out that want to go into business need to know something of what Ray Anderson understood at Interface Carpet Corporation. He wanted to make a company so that company didn't leave havoc for his grandchildren. Well, that's pretty interesting. And that meant figuring out how to make a product that he got back as a product of service. That meant having to do the master of the chemistry of making a product that he wanted to get back that could be dismantled and made into new carpet. And how you would then power that company by sunshine. So there were a lot of things about that that were really interesting issues. But he kept that company. That company prospers to this day after Ray Anderson died because he set it on a very different path. So this is doable. It is possible to do. And we needn't fall into despair and woe is us and so forth. But anyway, thanks for that question.
Corey Boren. I concur with your assessments. With the assumption that the United States, we have this greater sense of a global need, what would be the moral argument where our nation or the world nation would approach another individual nation such as Greenland, who's sitting on a huge reserve of oil, and say, you cannot develop that and give your people a quality of life? They're poor, and they see a huge amount of money for their economy. We have to say no. How do we do that? What is our moral argument?
Well, yeah, we're in an awkward position, aren't we? Because about 28% of the carbon in the atmosphere, the effects of which we're now suffering through, 28% was emitted within our borders by Americans, 28%. So think of this as a big bucket, and at the overflow point, we create climate havoc. We don't know exactly where that point, we don't know what the capacity is yet, but at 400, you know, Bill McKibben says 350 parts per million, but even at 350 parts per million, we were seeing things happen long before they were supposed to happen. And I'm inclined to believe that the safer level is going to be back down closer, a lot closer to 300 parts per million, but be that as it may. We're responsible for a whole lot of the carbon in the atmosphere. That fact is known, and it's known by people that have the black flag of ISIS. It's known by people all over the world in the third world countries. And so for us to come along, living like we do, with our average CO2 emissions at around 22 tons per person in this country, and tell them, hey, look, I'm sorry, guys, you can't industrialize. You can't burn that. You got to disinvent fire and have a nice day. Now, this is a world where people have the capacity. We democratize the means of terror. We've done that. If you want to make a nuclear bomb, you can go on the internet. You can find out. You can figure out most all of what you need to know right now on the internet. If you want to make heinous weapons of mass destruction, chemical and so forth, you can do that. We're in a world that is cheek to jowl. 7.2 billion of us will soon be 10 billion. There's got to be some give in this. We are going to have to give up something for safety. And so this bargain that we've got to strike is going to be interesting to people in Greenland or anywhere else in the world. We're going to have to say something along the lines that we will reduce our carbon emissions back down closer to two. Contraction and convergence is the term given to it in Europe. And we'll help you make a transition to a post-fossil fuel era. And what's that look like? Well, it looks actually pretty doable. It doesn't look hard. Now, let me step back. If we were a class and I said, hey, look, you've got the assignment of your class. There's only one assignment here. And we spend about $1 trillion on something we call security, and that leaves out a whole lot of surveillance and so forth. And that's our nuclear weapons, our wars, our Pentagon budget and so forth. So I'm going to give you $500 billion and see if you can make us more secure. Or let's say $100 billion and make us secure. What would you do? Well, one of the things you might want to consider is to shrink the U.S. footprint in the world. Another thing is to make sure people aren't always mad at us. Now, at the risk of going offending somebody's political beliefs, 9/11 happened. If you read, it's a good idea to read your enemies, by the way. You know, it should have been reading Mein Kampf in the 30s to find out what Hitler was up to. We didn't much read it. And we should have been paying attention to what Osama bin Laden was saying before 9/11. What he was saying was, your oil addiction keeps your troops in what in lands that we regard as sacred. Now, we can disagree with that, but we shouldn't have ignored it. And so one way to begin to think about this is to begin to think, okay, if I can shrink our Pentagon budget to, let's say, half of its current size, and I would do that by getting out of places. If we want to fight wars in the Middle East, that's one thing. But having to fight wars in the Middle East is a totally different thing. You follow what I'm saying? So if we've got to go fight for oil because we weren't smart enough to put ourselves in vehicles that get 50 to 100 miles per gallon, which would have been within the range of easy possibility, then we've got to spend a whole lot of money on Sixth Fleet and military and war fighting capability in the Middle East. You follow what I'm saying? This was poorly thought out, and I mean that is a vast understatement. So in taking, let's say, money that we've got, what would you do with $500 billion in this country? Well, one thing would be really nice to see high-speed rail come back in and get us off oil. It'd be really nice to see cities rebuild. It'd be nice to see better schools. So you could take a couple hundred billion of that for years and just begin to rebuild the infrastructure of this country, which gets when the professional engineers rate it, our infrastructure rates what? You know the number or the letter grade they gave it? It was either D minus, right? Or it was a D something. And so we don't rate very high. And then to help other countries begin to develop power systems, they don't need an electric grid. The electric grid is the largest machine humans have ever built. They don't need to replicate that. We've gone to a whole different era. That's like giving them typewriters or something that's irrelevant. The technology now allows us to produce power on site from sunshine and wind and microhydro. The technology now allows us to do all kinds of things. If you bought a refrigerator 20 or 25 years ago, you bought a machine that used 1,750 kilowatt hours per year on average. State of the art now is probably around 250. And so 1,750 to 250. Better machine, same cost, works better, uses a fraction of the electricity that it used to use. So beginning to disperse those technologies to third world countries. We don't just say, we don't unplug them and say, you can't burn this. We help them. So great question. And I think that the possibilities there are enormous. And then the collateral benefits is you make a world, not a perfect world, not a totally peaceful world, but a world structured where peace is a lot more likely outcome than it otherwise would be. You follow what I'm saying? We don't need to fight over energy, not now. And U.S., we will have to relinquish a good bit of our fossil fuel consumption. And we can do that. And all of you know the words Prius. And you think of lighting systems, an incandescent light bulb, 100 watts, you know, compact fluorescent, maybe 17 watts for the same 100 watts, LED, 4 watts. So 100 to 4. Technology here, it can help us in this. But this is really a moral and political dialogue. What should we do? What do we owe the world? And we stood aloof of these things for far too long. Anyway, sermon's over. It's a great question, by the way. Thanks for that.
How do you prepare best for a career in leadership and sustainability? Could you, can we create a greater impact through a career in government or through our own specific fields? Oh, sorry, my name's Ariel DeJesus.
Thank you. Thank you for that. How do you prepare for a career in sustainability or leadership? Let me say two things. One is that the idea of going into public service is really important. We've been through a 30-year, 40-year, whatever it is, in this part of the American psyche. We've always been indifferent about government, ever since George III, way back in 1775 and so forth. We've been very antagonistic towards centralized government. But a career in public service is really important. And we need young people with care about the conduct of the public business. We need young people in careers in public service, in politics and in federal bureaucracy and state bureaucracies and, you know, governor's levels. We need people of integrity and intelligence and creativity and real commitment. We need you in public service. Unfortunately, for 30 years, we've been told the government's a problem, and government can be a problem, but so can the University of Utah, and so can Oberlin College, and so can the Pentagon, and so can the National Security Agency. I mean, when you organize, you can create problems. And the issue here is, how do we engage as citizens in the public arena? That's where the public business is going to be translated or conducted. Everybody in the room is a consumer. That's our economic side. But everybody in the room is also a citizen. We're both of those things. But the citizenship part has atrophied pretty badly over the past 3 or 4 decades. Second thing on leadership, boy, this is so presumptive. Imagine a young Moses coming into his guidance counselor in, downtown Cairo, can I call you Mo? Your test results are in, and, man, you've got a wonderful aptitude for building, and Pharaoh's got this building program and so forth, and he's going to build these pyramid things. It's going to have, burial tombs and so forth, but it's going to be a big work program. And I read your essay here. And now, Mo, don't get me wrong. I mean, I really admire you want to lead your people to freedom and so forth. I really admire that. That's a wonderful goal. The part here down in paragraph 4 where you're going to part the waters, I mean, that's a little shaky to me. But Mo, just if I can just offer you some guidance, stay here in Cairo and help the Pharaoh build pyramids and so forth. I mean, this other's noble and all that. Do you get what I'm saying? You can pick whoever you want to pick. It's going to be presumptuous to say how their career would have unfolded. And again, back to one of the points I made earlier, you don't know what you can do in the world. You can't know that yet. But you can be bigger in the world than you can imagine at the age of 19 or 20 or 21. You can do more. And it's the same is probably true for everybody at any given age. We can be more and we can be bigger than we've been told or than we think about ourselves. And that's not encouragement to be prideful or anything else. It's just to say you can do more, I think, than we anticipate. So whatever, Gerda once said something to the effect that whatever you can do or dream that you can, begin it. For boldness has genius and magic and power in it. And so tap into the level of genius and magic and power that's in all of you. Hey, thank you very much.
I cannot imagine a better way to kick off our first Sustainability Award. So please join me again in thanking David Orr for being with us today. Of course, I also want Anno. And-